Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Luke's English podcast is made possible thanks to kind donations from listeners, and if you'd like to donate to the podcast, you can do so by clicking one of the yellow PayPal buttons on my website. Also, the podcast is supported by the premium subscription, and premium subscribers can access a growing library of language lessons from me to you that focus on the sort of natural English that comes up in conversations with guests on my podcast. I mine those conversations for target language, and then I present that language to you with explanations, plenty of examples, and I kind of broaden things out by looking at synonyms and collocations and plenty of other things. Also, there's pronunciation work in those episodes where I present you with sentences that contain the target language and you have to repeat after me. So the whole package, vocabulary, grammar, pronunciation, all of it, PDFs are available for you to download as well. To get all that content, you need to become a premium subscriber. And if you'd like to do that and find out more information, just go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info. You're listening to Luke's English podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk. Hello, listeners. I hope you're doing well today and that you are ready for this new episode of my podcast. You join me here in my pod room as the rain falls down on the roof above my head. I don't know if you can hear that in the background. Can you hear the sounds of the rain? There it is. It is pouring with rain here as I record this. The conditions are perfect for learning British English. So let's get started. So this is a continuation of this short series of episodes I'm doing about the Beatles, and this one focuses mostly on John Lennon. If you've ever wanted to know more about this iconic British musician, then this episode is for you. Also, if you're already a Beatles fan or a John Lennon fan, then I'm sure that you'll be glad to hear this conversation too. My guest for this episode is Anthony Rotuno from England, and Anthony is very knowledgeable about John Lennon and his life. In fact, I feel like I couldn't have found a better person to talk to about this subject. One of the reasons for that is that Anthony is also an English teacher. He's been teaching English as a foreign language to adults for over 18 years. And for obvious reasons, it's always useful to have a guest on this podcast who has experience of working with learners of English. Anthony is also a podcaster, so he is used to talking to audiences over the internet from his home in England. Anthony's podcast is all about John Lennon, and he probably knows all there is to know about John Lennon because he's read everything out there on the subject. And for his podcast, he has actually interviewed lots of people connected to Lennon, including authors and people who actually knew John himself, people with first-hand accounts of meeting him. So Anthony really knows a lot about John Lennon. And we had a really good, really long conversation for this podcast covering various things like John Lennon's life story. This is the first part of that conversation. So let me just explain my reasons for doing this series of episodes about the Beatles. I probably don't need to explain this, but allow me to give my reasons. So this is a 5-part series, actually. I published the first part with my mum in episode 717, which was a review of a book about the Beatles, followed by a general Beatles ramble. And the rest of the series will be this conversation I had with Anthony, divided into 4 parts. But it's not just going to be us rambling on about John Lennon for all that time. I've also decided to employ some of Anthony's English teaching skills in order to cover some language too, specifically in parts 3, 4, and 5 of this series, as we focus on descriptive adjectives for describing personality traits, and then some analysis of the lyrics from Beatles songs with various nice phrases and and idioms to learn. So there should be plenty of English learning opportunities to take from this whole series. John Lennon is a hugely significant person in terms of modern history. And of course, being English, he is very much part of our culture. And as we move forwards in time, it seems that the significance of the Beatles and everyone's interest in them is not waning. If anything, they continue to grow in stature. And even if you're not into the Beatles, hopefully this can be a chance to learn some new things about this band that is held in such high esteem by so many people. And I promise you, okay, I'm willing to say that I promise you here that if you listen to this, you will know more about John Lennon at the end than you did before you listened to it. Okay, I promise that you will learn some new things about John Lennon. And if you're wondering when we're going to get to the music as well, part five will be all about Beatles lyrics, and there will be some guitar playing in there as well. So we will be getting to the music and lyrics eventually. First of all, though, in this episode, we will get to know Anthony a little bit and ask him about his podcasts. And then you'll hear him talk about how he got into the Beatles and John Lennon in particular. And then Anthony is going to give us a brief overview of John's life and career. And finally, I'm going to ask Anthony a few John Lennon discussion questions at the end. Okay, so I'll talk to you again on the other side of this conversation. But for now, let's get started. Let's meet Anthony and let's talk about John Lennon and stuff. And here we go. Anthony, hello. Welcome to my podcast. Welcome onto my podcast. How are you today?
I'm very well, Luke. How are you doing?
I'm fine. It's nice to talk to you finally after having sort of exchanged lots of emails with you and after having listened to a few episodes of one of your podcasts. Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. By the way, I'm not officially working, but you know, if I think of any good idioms while we're talking, don't worry, I'll introduce them into the conversation.
Yes, yes, exactly. Very good. Because you are an English teacher, as well as being a podcaster and a Beatles fan and John Lennon fan and all those sorts of things. You are an English teacher. So let's see. Well, let me ask you a few questions just to kind of get to know you a bit before we dig into the subject of the Beatles and John Lennon and things like that. So, Anthony, so where are you? Well, where are you right now, in fact?
I'm just outside London, Tunbridge in Kent.
Okay.
I originally grew up in a place called Egham. Have you ever heard of Egham? Just off the M25. Yeah, I've done a few other guest appearances and I sent them like a profile thing. And the joke was that Egham is a town that's so small that some of the people who live there have never heard of it. So, yeah, it's near Runnymede, which is slightly famous. But I've been a teacher for 18 years. So I got my diploma in 2003 from International House in London.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, great. Teaching for 18 years. And so have you lived in different places? Have you moved around? Because that's what we do, isn't it, English teachers? We often will go off and live somewhere else.
Yeah, we have this wonderful license to do that, yes. I lived in the Far East, mostly Thailand, but I did live in Laos briefly as well. And then Italy in Bologna, which is sort of northern Italy, and then Madrid in Spain. Until a couple of years ago, and now I'm teaching online, and now I can't even imagine leaving the house to teach. We were talking off air about podcasts, and I think podcasts saved me when I was in Madrid because I did so much traveling on public transport. But the idea that you can spend the whole day like learning, you know, listening to Luke's podcast as well as other ones, that the fact you can just spend the whole day just learning while you're traveling between classes, I mean, what could be better?
It's amazing,
but,
isn't it?
I do quite like being able to teach in my living room.
Yes. You know? Yeah, it is quite nice not to have to get on public transport to get to wherever it is you're teaching. Yeah, that is a convenient thing.
Yes.
Okay. And so I was going to say, so as English teachers, obviously, we are there to help people learn English. But what have you learned from being an English teacher?
That's a great question. I found myself a niche in the last sort of 5 or 6 years as an advanced teacher. So when I was in Spain, I specialized in preparing students for the Cambridge exams, the FCE and the what used to be called the CA, not CIA, CAE, you know, advanced.
CIA.
Cambridge Advanced, yeah.
And, CAE, yeah.
CAE, yeah. I think they just call it the Cambridge Advanced now, but anyway. Okay. Yeah, so someone's obviously employed I did find out somebody's actually employed to slightly tweak the exam, including the name, every few years to make it seem like, you know, progress anyway.
And so that they can then sell lots of new textbooks and things.
Of course, yeah, yeah. What have I learned? Well, I mean, I have always loved language. So this might sound strange for a native speaker to say that their English is improving, but I'm sure you'd agree that when you teach advanced students, some of the advanced students, because they're studying full time and you're not, there may be a case, hopefully not too often, where, you know, they may know something that you don't, or which is, I think, is a positive thing. So, I mean, it's improved my English. I'm a bit of a grammar geek. I just love language. So I learn a lot. And also I get to, because my students are generally advanced, they can all hold a conversation very well. I do kind of get to introduce things that I want to talk about as well, you know, only because mostly with most of them, you probably find this, you say to them, what would you like to study? And they'll just say, oh, you know, whatever you want. You know, I don't know if you find that, but
yeah,
there's very few students will actually want to kind of design their own curriculum, which is fine, you know. So I use a lot of TED Talks. So I get to learn loads about the world, you know, because I'm very, very curious for knowledge. You know, I mean, basically a knowledge addict, I suppose. So I've learned loads. And obviously, you know, with the teaching, you hone your craft, just like podcasting. So, I think the fact that I still want to learn, like I haven't got to the point where I've got sort of jaded. I mean, obviously now and again, you know, when you have to repeat the same lessons too much, it can get a bit, much. But I think I'm still trying to learn and still trying to feel like I want to get to the point where someone can just ask me any grammar question and I can just like fire off the answer, you know, and it's not easy, but... So, yeah, I learned a lot about myself and about English, basically, and about, I suppose, psychology, because I did study psychology at college. So, you know, I'm very interested in sort of class dynamics, and because I've played in bands as well, band dynamics. I think dynamics between people are absolutely fascinating. So
yeah, that's
kept my interest going, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So what was that, psychology at university,
was it? Yeah.
Degree in psychology.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And then, you're a musician too.
Yeah, I've had quite weird trajectories, yes. So these were the days, like the 90s was the days when you could do a degree just because you liked the subject. You weren't necessarily looking for it to lead to a job. Like I never thought of becoming a psychologist. I just liked psychology and I wanted to get a degree. And then after that, I did accountancy for a while, which, is a...
Accountancy.
Try and work that one out. How did I get from psychology to accountancy? Who knows? But I guess I was quite good at with numbers and stuff like that. And then I've never really made any money from music, but I've always played it. And then I became a teacher in about 2003, and now I got to live in all these lovely places. And now I'm settled back in England, relatively settled. You know, I don't really want to move around, but I suppose sometimes if you have like an inner nomad, sometimes you find yourself doing that. But I would like to stay in England now because I'm in my 40s and I don't quite have the sort of wanderlust that I used to have, you know.
Very nice little Paul McCartney reference there.
Oh, yes, yes. Good song.
Unwittingly, yeah, great song. And of course, now with podcasting and stuff, and as you said, teaching on Zoom, there's actually no need to travel around that much. Not that we can at this stage. But yeah, podcasting. So you also, as well as listening to podcasts and stuff over the years, you do your own podcasts. Three of them, no less than three.
Only three, yeah.
Tell us about the three podcasts that you do.
Okay, well, chronologically, so the one that's, I guess, is pertinent to today's conversation is Glass Onion on John Lennon. Glass Onion is the name of a Beatles song from the White Album, primarily written by John Lennon. It's weird. I still listen to podcasts, but when I was only a podcast listener, I would go to iTunes every now and again and plug in John Lennon and think, there must be someone who's done a podcast about John Lennon. Like, how can someone not have done that? Because there was loads of Beatles ones even then, and obviously there's even more now. There's a couple of Paul McCartney ones. Obviously, Paul McCartney's current, you know, still bringing out music. I thought, yeah, someone's got to step into that. And I have always been, I suppose, a Lennon guy. that's kind of changing a little bit because my, as I said on a recent guest appearance I did, I'm getting to the point where my opinion of John Lennon is going slightly down. Like, it's just the fact that the more you learn about him, that he did have quite a nasty side. And you also learn that perhaps Paul McCartney contributed more to his songs than he did to Paul's songs. Just stuff like that. But anyway, there was basically a gap, and I used the psychology knowledge. You know, it's not really one of those podcasts that's sort of straight reviews of albums or done a few reviews. It's more like, for example, we pick a year. So John Lennon in 1966. But we get to also talk about the news events of the year. So I think the way I've managed to broaden it out to, I mean, I've done over 70 episodes and some of them are an hour and a half to 2 hours. So it's quite a lot of content. Is just to broaden it out. And so take something about John Lennon and then branch it out. And then looking at psychology, and I don't know if you've been listening recently, but I've become my gimmick, which wasn't something I planned, has become this sort of, have you heard about this Coleman and Goldman thing that I've been doing?
I have heard about this, Coleman and Goldman, the two authors, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, they both wrote books on him in the 80s, and one was probably a bit too nice, and it was that kind of thing you often find, that sort of mainstream friendly where everything's sort of tied up in a nice little bow, obviously apart from the murder. That's not, I don't mean it in that way, but yeah. His life up to then is, it's all tied up quite neatly. And then Goldman was this book which absolutely outraged the Lennon community, but the thing is, over the last year I've managed to talk to quite a few people, including a lady who was actually Sean Lennon's playmate, and she's always apologizing to me for not being older, because she was only 4 or 5. So she says, oh, my memories are just so hazy. But what we're finding perhaps more and more is that perhaps the Goldman version was more accurate than we thought. And that, you know, maybe he wasn't quite what, you know, his devotees would like to think. And just one more thing on that. Interestingly, there's been a book by Peter Doggett. Have you ever read You Never Give Me Your Money, the Beatles book?
No. No, I haven't.
That would be a huge recommendation about the solo careers, yeah. He's a really good author, and he was just about to publish a book called Prisoner of Love, John Lennon Inside the Dakota, and it's just been cancelled.
Oh, really? Why?
Well, that's the thing.
Yoko?
That's the thing, yeah, maybe, because Yoko, I don't know if you know this, but she actually sued Fred Seaman again.
I heard you say that. We're getting deep into things already.
I know, sorry.
Like, no one knows who Fred Seaman is.
Sorry,
actually,
yes,
but
yes,
before
yes.
we get into... This is fascinating, Anthony, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but...
No, no problem.
We're going to get into the details and describing John and also looking at some language that we could use to describe John Lennon and his life.
Yeah.
And probably showing perhaps the well-known version... and the slightly less known version about, you know, what was really going on in his life in different times.
Yeah. Should I talk about the other podcast?
Yeah. Tell us quickly about the other two podcasts, and then we need to do a little bit of an overview of John Lennon's life just to bring everyone up to speed. That's going to be easy, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Just a quick overview. Anyway, yeah. So Glass Onion on John Lennon's more of a sort of psychology look at his life. And then I just started two other ones quite recently. So in December was Film Gold, which is a film program. And I noticed in your back episodes, you had an interview with Rob Ager, who I've actually become a friend of, because I have a connection with Liverpool for obvious reasons. And I went to meet him as a fan, and we kind of became friends. And I'm hoping to get him on the show at some
Great.
Point. Because yeah. I love Rob Ager. His film analysis is amazing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He will analyze things in great detail. It's really interesting to listen to him. Plus, I love his Scouse accent.
Yeah, yeah, because it's a soft Scouse. It's not such a it's not a guttural Scouse.
It's not a Stevie Gerrard kind of thing.
No. Anyway, that's Film Gold. So I've just started that. I think I've done about 6 episodes. And then the third one is Life and Life Only. And the joke with that is that it's a podcast about life, so I'm never going to run out of material. Because, you know, John Lennon, as much as I enjoy talking about him, you know, about 150 hours on one person, there must be a point where I'm going to run out. Film, I'm obviously not going to run out. But, yeah, Life and Life Only is a search for inner and outer truth. So the inner truth side would be sort of life coaching, self-development, meditation, things like that, and sort of personal psychology or positive psychology. And then the outer truth part is sort of is alternative media, because I've been involved. I'll just be very brief. About 10 or 15 years ago, I got involved in what used to be called the truth movement, but they kind of dropped that moniker because truth is a bit sort of saying, oh, I've got the truth, doesn't really work well with people. So we call it alternative media. And I've appeared on a few podcasts, and it's the basic premise of it is that nowadays, I don't know if you agree with this, but pretty much everything that's not on the news that might seem important is dismissed as a conspiracy theory, you know? And yes, conspiracy theories, you know, I've never investigated the moon landings. You know, I don't go into like the silly ones like Elvis or Bigfoot or anything like that. But what I noticed a long time ago is that there's a massive strand of history that we just never told about. You know, you never see it on the news. You never see it in your history classes. So, but it's still using psychology because the way I'm sort of trying to tie the two strands together is that the inner part is about, you know, kind of developing your armor almost, you know, your self-development. And then the outer part is how you then look at information. So this is where the kind of perhaps the angrier side of my personality, I'm generally a pretty calm person, but the way that people consume mainstream media and continuously react in the last 4 years, all you really see is people reacting to Trump. And I'm not saying that what Trump did wasn't significant, but there's always a kind of the men behind the curtain, so to speak. There's always people pulling the strings, you know, like the war machine, for example. And it doesn't really matter whether it's Obama or Trump or Bush. The people behind the scenes are kind of carry on. There's a sort of continuum of, you know, the war machine and American foreign policy, for example, that carries on regardless. So that's in a nutshell. So it's sort of inner and outer truth, let's call it.
That's sort of like the idea that the information that we get from our primary sort of news sources that you get on the telly and stuff like that, it forms a kind of baseline of this is what's going on in the world, and people just react and to that baseline. But you seem to be talking about the idea that, you know, there could be other things going on, and that there are other versions of you know, history and of news and things like that. And it's about sort of keeping an open mind and being prepared to kind of think critically about every single thing that you know, you read and see and things like that, while also developing yourself too. It's very interesting.
Yeah, because I mean, really, really, my argument, I mean, I could give anyone who wanted to have a discussion about this, I could give you plenty of evidence of things which are provable. Because in fact, you know, I don't want to get too heavy, but you know, the English government, the American government, they do actually publish most of their history. It's just you never see it on the news. So now we've got the internet, and yes, you know, people will say, oh, the internet is full of, you know, rubbish or unfounded theories. And yes, there are, but there's also plenty of stuff that's on the official record. And you know, as I said, rather than me kind of consuming the news, I mean, I have a look at like the facts of what's happened, but I just don't really read mainstream opinions. And almost to prove that there's alternative is that the term mainstream media didn't actually exist about 15, 20 years ago. It's only called mainstream media because there's now an alternative. Before it used to be called the media.
Yeah.
So that's a bit of progress, let's call it. But yeah, I mean, there's just loads and loads of history, and there are lots of things happening around the world. And the idea that a news agency could, of all the things that are happening 24 hours a day around the world, the idea that they could pick a few and say, this is all you need to know. Yeah. You know, it's kind of laughable if you think about it. But
especially the idea that, you know, just a 30-minute news program, and they've got to just pick out. Yeah, just the whole paradigm. The whole paradigm is, in a sense, sort of limiting in that, if you just restrict 30 minutes to news, and then there's the whole, also the style in which the information is presented to you.
Oh, yes.
With, you know, dun, 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 this is the news. And, yeah. You know, that thing that was so cleverly parodied by Chris Morris in The Day to Day and Brass Eye.
Oh, yeah,
And yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, listeners, if you'd like to hear more of this kind of thing, then you could listen to Anthony's podcast called Life and Life Only. And if you want more of the film analysis, and stuff, then you could listen to Film Gold. In fact, you talked about Groundhog Day recently, which I also talked about with my mum.
I know, I did listen to that, because when I'm about to do a film podcast, I obviously watch documentaries. If I've got the DVD, I lap up all the extras and stuff, and then I look for podcasts. So I did listen to you and your good mother talking about that. They're very interesting, yeah. Really good.
Okay, so shall we get into the Beatles and John Lennon then?
Let's do it.
All right then, everyone, are you ready? Here we go. All right, so first of all, well, I'm going to start with a sort of standard question, which was like, what was your introduction to the Beatles? How did you first get into the Beatles? And then, you know, why John Lennon in particular?
Okay, well, yeah, I mean, obviously, you're from England as well, so the Beatles are everywhere. You know, you can't possibly avoid them when you're growing up. So I kind of knew, as I was a kid, I was sure I knew, you know, Yellow Submarine or Obladiah Obladar. But it was when I was about 13 or 14. I have a sister, Marina. She's been mentioned a lot because I've told this story a few times. So, she was a big music fan. She was far more advanced than I was. And this is like the mid-'80s, mid to late 80s. I was listening to stuff like, I don't know, Duran Duran, who, you know, I still think are a right band. U2, but she was more like the Smiths and sort of slightly less commercial. Anyway, one day she appeared with this vinyl record called Beatles, a collection of Beatles oldies and goldies.
Yeah, we had the same one.
Oh, did you? Yeah.
Oh, it's got the psychedelic cover of a kind of Carnaby Street kind of guy in flashy clothes, sort of on the front. Yeah, yeah. We had the same
one. That's the one. Yeah, and then the Beatles in Japan on the back.
Right.
Yeah, and to cut a long story short, like the 80s singles, they all tended to be sort of 4 minutes. And if you listen back to a lot of those singles, they always seem to sort of fade out for about a minute. They always seem to go a bit longer than they need to be. So anyway, my sister said, oh, have a listen to this. And I was like, oh, it's the Beatles. It's a bit old. Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, we started listening to it. And like, I remember the first two songs is She Loves You and then From Me to You. And they actually had the running times on it. And She Loves You is like 2 minutes, 5 seconds. For Me to You is 1 minute, 58. It was like, wow. And the songs just kind of leapt off the speakers because I've been conditioned to this sort of 80s. Everything's a bit drawn out. Everything's a bit kind of new romantics, you know, Spandau Ballet and all that. And now suddenly you've got this thing where one of the things about Beatles music, they never waste a single second. There's always something interesting going on. So I listened to this record and then on the same record, suddenly 2 years later from She Loves You, you've got Yesterday. And then a year after that, you've got Eleanor Rigby. And weirdly enough, the last two songs on that record is Eleanor Rigby, followed by One I Hold Your Hand. And if you listen to those two together, you're thinking, how can this be the same band? And that's 3 years apart. And then with John Lennon, Marina again, she bought me the Ray Coleman book that we were talking about earlier, the Nice Biography. And I was just absolutely captivated. And in fact, it was the only time I was a good boy at school, the only time I ever bunked off school.
There's a good phrase, listeners, to bunk off school.
Yeah, bunk off, sag off school is a bit of an old-fashioned one. But
when you just don't go to school one day.
Yeah, it wasn't that I didn't go to school. I used to go home for lunch. I just forgot to come back to school.
But normally when kids bunk off school, it means they sort of lie to their parents or something, or they pretend to go and then they actually end up drifting off with a friend or something and go into town or go and get up to mischief and things like that, do naughty things. You went home for lunch and you stayed at home because you got stuck into this book.
Oh my God, yeah. And I just was just absolutely captivated. And perhaps one of the things we'll get to later is how John Lennon's image was somewhat manufactured after he died, which it sounds very cynical, but unfortunately that does happen. You know, a sort of image of someone is constructed and the public feel different about someone after they've died, because you're never going to see them again, you know. So I think a little bit of it was the image, but I think he's still a fascinating character. So I kind of went from there, really, and I kind of became a Beatles fan and a sort of a John Lennon solo fan almost simultaneously. And then I had the most wonderful, you know, I ditched all my 80s, like it was like, oh, I didn't listen to that anymore. Sort of picked up current music more in the 90s. So there was a period from about late 80s to the early 90s. I just had this amazing thing where I've just got all these Beatles and John Lennon records. And it was almost a bit like someone in the 60s consuming them. But the difference is I didn't have to wait for them to come out. Like, they were already there. So all I had to do was go to the library, and it was cassettes in those days, which is, it's nice to think that you had to wait for songs, that you had to wind forward and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just had this, just this amazing 2 or 3 years, and I learned to play the guitar at the same time. And the thing is that it's never stopped. That's the thing. At the point where I knew all their records, suddenly you got, you know, you had Live at the BBC, Anthology, Isolated Tracks, books, podcasts. It's the phrase I always use. It's the gift that keeps giving, which is a good phrase, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm sure I've used that too when talking about being a Beatles fan. It is the gift that keeps on giving. It's even though, it, you know, they were only recording for 7 or 8 years.
7 years.
Yeah. 7 years. And, you know, it's a definitely a limited amount of stuff. But for some reason, I do keep going back to it. It just keeps bringing more things to me. I mean, we're talking about the Beatles now, and I'm well aware that a lot of people listening to this will not really be fans in the way that we are. And also, some people will just have one sort of image of the Beatles. Like, I've got some friends who just aren't really into them, in fact, find them sort of annoying. And it seems to be one particular image, like the kind of black and white era Fab Four stuff, where they were quite manufactured in those days to an extent, in the sense that they'd been put in suits and they were doing a lot of publicity and the kind of commercial side of things. But there is, when you scrape below the surface of that sort of image and even do things like watch them in press conferences or watch them in interviews on television, what always strikes me is that they are so kind of timeless or so modern. It's like four people from today sort of stuck in the past in a way. And that's one of the fun things about watching them in interviews and in press conferences, is that the world around them seems so old fashioned and so dated and so of its time. But then these four guys just seem like normal people, just like they would be today. In fact, you know, it feels like they are just totally modern and sort of out of time in a strange way. They were so natural and charismatic and charming, and yeah, it's endlessly interesting and enjoyable. It's positive. It makes me feel good.
Yeah, that's the other thing.
All that stuff.
Yeah, it's a very good thing you picked up on there. Yeah, I always think of it as, it's like they were in on a joke that nobody else understood.
Yeah.
But in a funny way, they almost were, because they came from Liverpool, and in those days, the accents were much broader. Because now we sort of moved to cities, you don't really get those old. Yeah, if you watch like old episodes of Coronation Street, I don't know if any of your listeners, sure, there's some English listeners have heard of that. That's Manchester, obviously, but the accents you hear in Coronation Street are not the same now, because they were so broad in those days. And in fact, you know, I think maybe like people in London, obviously there was a snobbishness about, there's always been a snobbishness about the North and the South in England. In a funny way, they probably didn't really understand their accents. And the Beatles had so many in-jokes because they'd spent so much time together in Hamburg that they almost had like a secret language. So you're absolutely right. It was almost like the rest of the world was this thing that they were almost tolerating, but they were sending it up continuously in subtle ways.
Yeah, they're constantly making fun because the four of them were so close and so tight, so tightly knit as a group. This happens with bands that spend all their time together. When they're playing music, they listen extremely closely to each other. They work as a unit, and they were called, I don't know who called them this. Was it Mick Jagger? The four-headed beast?
Four-headed monster.
Four-headed monster, right? Yeah, yeah. And they were a bit like that. One organism with four heads. And so they all knew what each other was thinking. They would set up jokes and then knock them down. They would finish each other's sentences. They would, absolutely, like John would go off on some funny thing and the others were able to keep up with him. And so they were incredibly strong in that sense. And so, yeah, they had that kind of secret language thing and we were all part of it. You know, if you could just tune into it, then you can kind of become part of it. So that's, again, one of the nice things about watching all that Beatles stuff is that I always feel like I'm sort of spending time with some friends.
That's it, yeah.
So let's talk about John Lennon then. So we've talked about why you were fascinated by him because you read that Coleman book. And I mean, Lennon is a fascinating character. And to me, you know, very well, because you've, you know, you spend a lot of time talking about him and reading about him and so on. But for many of my listeners, they might not be aware of the general story. So this is going to be, it's going to be tricky to keep some discipline here, but let's try to give a basic overview of John Lennon's life. I'll let you handle this.
Okay, I'll be back in about half an hour. So, no, I'm kidding. All right, this is the very, very potted version. So, obviously, everyone will know he came from Liverpool, 1940, wartime baby. I suppose the way to know John Lennon is to drill down to two or three events that happened to him that probably kind of shaped his life. And basically, he, again, doing a podcast for 2 years, if John Lennon was alcohol, I've almost drunk myself sober. Because you get to a point where the more there's a song lyric, the more you learn, the less you know, or the less you know for sure, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, but the stuff we know anyway. So he came from ostensibly a broken home, had a very strange upbringing where his mother was somewhat wayward, let's say. Although I think she had a heart of gold as well. And I say nearly all of this stuff is contentious, but essentially he never really knew his father. His father was a seaman. And his mother, at age 5, either gave him away or, according to a recent biography, his aunt Mimi, who some may have heard of, took him, or basically bullied Julia, his mother, into giving John to her. So John Lennon was raised by his auntie and his uncle. And then he found out at a certain point that his mother was living nearby. So if you've seen the film Nowhere Boy, which is quite a big recommendation, essentially he was raised by his aunt and his mother was more of a kind of an aunt figure. So it was almost like a weird reversal of these two roles.
Of the four Beatles, he was probably the middle class one.
Yeah, that's right. But again, it's a tiny bit of revisionism because he grew up in what, a two up and two down. That's a quaint expression for
What's
your listeners
that?
There. Two up and two down. So you've just got basically a living room. You've got sort of two rooms or windows on each floor. So very, very basic sort of square-shaped house. Very basic. So a living room and probably a back room and then a couple of bedrooms. So he grew up in the Penny Lane area until he was 5. And then he moved to this place called Woolton, which is basically a village. If you ever go there, it's one of the better areas of Liverpool. So yeah, he was a bit more middle class. So again, there's so much of John Lennon. I just want to make this clear that a lot of it is very contentious. But the stuff we know, he lived with his aunt. His mother was around, as I said. And then the two really seminal events of his youth were when he was 16, he started a skiffle group called the Quarrymen. And he played at a village fete. And that gives you an idea of what Woolton was like, really. It was a village fete with a tombola and all that kind of thing.
The sort of event where school kids would go and entertainment for the family, and it would be outdoors.
Garden party, basically.
Yeah.
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 And so he plays with the Quarrymen, and he sticks out like a sore thumb because he was sort of trying to be a teddy boy. But one of the things that I discovered from talking to one of his bandmates is that John Lennon didn't actually get into a lot of fights. He was more, he had the gift of the gab, which means he was very quick-witted. He was very good. He could come up with a line to get himself out of trouble.
Yeah. But he had the, he gave the impression of being hard and dangerous and stuff. But in fact, no, he never actually got into physical fights. He was probably quite soft, really, in
a
sense.
Yeah, maybe a couple of fights against probably smaller boys, to be honest, because there was a bullying aspect to him as well. So, yeah, he meets, goes to this village fete, and in the audience is a 15-year-old Paul McCartney, looking very dapper in a sort of white blazer with a carnation. And so he hears, and what is the most unbelievable thing about that day, which just still blows my mind, is that when they performed in the church hall in the evening after Paul had gone home, someone recorded it.
What, really?
I mean, what are the chances? A fella called Bob Molyneux, who was well known to the Quarrymen, who I spoke to, actually recorded the whole performance, but of course, not knowing what would happen in later years, he wiped most of it.
No, he deleted it, not realizing.
He deleted most of it, not realizing. Because, yeah, to be honest, when you listen to it, to me, it's absolutely... I mean, I'd probably listen to it 100 times because it's just... To me, it's just like this amazing, like, archaeological thing, this recording, the fact that they met at a village fete and someone recorded it. It's almost like, ugh, must be preordained, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, he meets Paul, and then they actually meet George Harrison very soon after. And by the end of 57, you've got the nucleus of the Beatles. Obviously, Ringo is very important, but you've got the main three guys already in place by 57. And then the other big event that we have to mention is 1958 in July. His mother, Julia, is tragically killed by an off-duty policeman. And again, there was another myth that he was drunk. He absolutely was not drunk, but he was a learner driver who was off duty.
He hit her with his car.
He hit her with his car, and it was basically just outside, almost just outside where John Lennon was living. So if you think about it, every time John Lennon subsequently looked out of his bedroom window, he could see the spot where it happened. Now, obviously, he wouldn't have known the spot because he wasn't there, and I'm sure he didn't say to anyone, oh, can you tell me where it happened? It wasn't that, but... yeah, this terrible event, because he had lots of people, John Lennon had lots of people die on him, as he said. His uncle had died, his uncle who had been like a father. Anyway, one of the very important things is that he then found out after meeting Paul McCartney that Paul McCartney's mother had died a couple of years earlier of breast cancer. And I don't think you can downplay the effect this bond that it created between these two guys. And then you've got all the stuff about, as we said earlier, they bunked off school. The fact that Paul was left-handed and John was right-handed, so it was almost like looking into a mirror.
When they sat opposite each other playing guitars, it's like a mirror image, which is very helpful if you're trying to see what the other guy is playing. And also, yeah, on the stage, it looked really, really cool.
Absolutely. There's a weird, well, not weird, but there was a kind of symmetry about it. Yeah, so to cut a very long story short, they get this skiffle band going, they transition to rock and roll, they go to Hamburg, and when they start in Hamburg, they're really a pretty terrible band. But through an unbelievable number of hours, in their second trip to Hamburg, I can never remember the exact number, it's somewhere between 89 and 92 consecutive nights of about 5 hours each.
Whoa.
Yeah, so... essentially, you know, if you've got what it takes, that's a hell of a good, you know. Yeah, you're talking about the 10,000 hours, the Malcolm Gladwell thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's so much amazing story. You know, I'm cutting it very short here, but, you know, they make it in... well, they meet Brian Epstein in 61.
When they come back to Liverpool.
When they come back to Liverpool, yeah. Mm-hmm. In Hamburg, they were a band, a sort of leather band, very rough and ready, leather jackets. He, again, this is contentious. Did he persuade them to go into suits? Did they do it willingly? Who knows? Don't ask me. I only have a podcast about him. And then obviously they make it. And then from 62 is when they first record. So the first single is Love Me Do. And 69 is when they last record. And the last album comes out in 70. So as you said earlier, essentially in 7 years, they completely turn the world of pop music on its head. They revolutionized fashion. They revolutionized the whole way that recording is done. If I could just give you one example, when they went into the recording studio, first of all the technicians, this is hilarious, wore white coats.
Like in a science lab, right? Laboratory.
Or a lunatic asylum. Because if you think about how mad John Lennon sort of turned out to be, and I say that with a smile, obviously. It's quite funny that they're in white coats. It's just hilarious. But yeah. When the Beatles first appeared, essentially you would have recording sessions. I think it was like 1 to 4, 4 to 7, 7 to 10, or with breaks or whatever. By the end of the Beatles recording studio, they're smoking weed in the studio and they're recording all night. And they're just recording whenever they feel like it. Because, you know, they're sort of creative people, they're eccentric, they're high. You know, you put all that together, they're making the rules because they've basically...
They're the cash cow for the entire record company at that stage. So they've been just given free reign of the studio. It's like, okay, boys, you know, just you can use the studio as much as you like. Just keep pumping out the records.
That's it. And it's just amazing, yeah. That's just cutting it short, cutting a long story very short. And John Lennon, then he had another, unfortunately only had another 10 years of life after that. And I guess everybody knows what happened in the end. But
I would like to state as well, you know, the trajectory of their lives once they did sort of become known, that they went from being obviously just unknown four guys, just not knowing what was going to happen in the future, to like rocketing to a level that had never been seen before. I mean, Elvis was popular, but not to the same extent as the Beatles. They were, yeah, something totally without precedent, in the sense that the crowds, the madness that followed them around, yeah, just the crowds and the screaming and the levels of fame where almost every single person on the planet knew them, and they got to the point where they must have been surrounded by sycophants who were desperate to get to them, desperate to kind of have contact with them, and desperate to use them for something. Like, all the politicians started to want to be interviewed with them, and everyone's naming them for this, that, and the other. All of the most respected music critics were talking about them, either positively or negatively, and it just seemed the Beatles suddenly just became this global currency. And for the four individuals in the middle of that storm, it must have been, on one hand, an amazing ride, but also it's very traumatic, and it must have been psychologically a massive thing to deal with. I think John was probably quite traumatized in some cases, like the episode in 1966 where he said some things about the church and about Jesus, and those things were taken out of context. And then in America, in the sort of Bible Belt of America, where they're quite sort of, you know, fundamentalist about these things, they faced a lot of stuff, a lot of death threats. The Ku Klux Klan were suggesting that they were going to do something, and they all thought they were going to be killed. And I think that John, you would know more about this, but I think that John had moments of fear about his own life. They all did. Mm. They were all scared for their lives. This is how big this thing got. They thought, this thing's going to kill us. It's going to crush us somehow. Mm. And sort of arguably, it did get two of them in the end, John and George. So, yes, hitherto seen levels of fame, which just were utterly life-changing.
Yeah, I was trying to think of a comparison. You will, of course, remember Take That.
Yeah.
Right. Let's just do a little comparison. I'm not sure this comparison totally works, but I'm going to run with it anyway. So when the Beatles first emerged in 63, I think people loved their music, but I think they loved the energy of it, and they didn't think there was any sophistication. Now, I'm sure you've played Beatles songs on your guitar before, as I have many times. Mm. What you actually realize is that the early songs were actually quite sophisticated. Musically, not lyrically. We'll get to that later, I think. But musically, there was a lot more going on than it seems. And I actually feel that listeners probably pick up on that without realizing it. So they think they're just dancing to just a simple song, but there may be a chord change, you know, just something silly like that, that they actually react to, and they don't quite realize it. But try and imagine. So let's use Take That as an example. So they emerged in the 90s.
Take That, they were a boy band from the 90s, and they were probably the biggest boy band in the 90s. Screaming fans, teenage girls went crazy about them. Robbie Williams was a
Gary
member
Barlow.
Gary Barlow. Robbie Williams and Gary Barlow were members of Take That. Yes.
Yeah. So essentially, it was kind of almost exactly 30 years later as well. I remember at the time it was very much compared. Try and imagine Gary Barlow's a decent songwriter, I think. You know, I don't know much of his stuff. Robbie Williams is a good performer. Imagine if, I don't know, Robbie Williams, Gary Barlow, and who are the other ones? Jason, somebody, I can't remember.
Jason Orange and Mark, someone, I can't remember.
I can't remember, yeah. It's always the other two, yeah.
Yeah.
The other three or whatever. Imagine if all three of those emerged as amazing, creative, groundbreaking songwriters. And imagine if 4 years after that, they're being hailed as these sort of LSD mystics,
gurus of sorts.
Gurus, yeah, because that's the amazing thing. The Beatles had this incredible fame as a boy band, as you said, quite manufactured but with real talent. And then they had this totally different type of fame where they're seen as like mystics, which is all a bit silly. In the Summer of Love, I still believe in it, but then, you know, if you study the Vietnam War, you realize that the same time that there's all, you know, all you need is love, there's horrendous things happening in Vietnam, you know?
Except that, you know, you could argue that the whole peace and love movement was a direct reaction to the violence that was going on in somewhere like Vietnam.
Yeah, maybe.
It's very naive to go around putting flowers in the ends of rifles of police and soldiers. But I think that I think a lot of people were aware of it, and they thought rather than hate being the driving force or control being the driving force, they were just interested in love and beauty and things like that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I think you're right, but I'm not sure where the point came when the hippies became sort of anti-war activists and those two things got joined, because it's actually surprising how little reaction there was to Vietnam until a certain point, like 67, 68 even. So I think you're right. At some point that happened. But anyway, yeah, I mean, it's just amazing that this sort of two types of fame they had.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, just continuing just in the 70s, you know, the Beatles split up. John Lennon pursued his solo career. He was with Yoko Ono and, you know, this Japanese conceptual artist and stuff. And there are mixed opinions about her and things like that. And then, yes, he moved to New York with Yoko. The official narrative is that he kind of sort of stopped playing music in the mid 70s and focused on family life and became a sort of a house husband. And there, you know, the official narrative is that he was in domestic bliss, making bread every day. And then he came back to music in 1980 with the album he made with Yoko, Double Fantasy. And then he was murdered by a man in the street who, I mean, how do you describe him?
Yeah, again, I've done a couple of shows on him. I mean, a lot of Beatles fans don't even want to mention his name, which I'm fine with that. You know, I understand that. But it's actually a very interesting case. We don't know whether he was a big fan or not. I think he was just a very, very confused person who identified with John Lennon, as a lot of young men, as I did as well. But I just didn't take that path of identifying with him and just decided that John Lennon had sold out, which, again, is arguably true. And then, but I think he was just very disturbed, very confused, much like the guy who attacked George, as you said earlier.
Yeah, I mean, again, when you reach that level of fame, and there's, like, you know, George Harrison, I think, once said, you know, what was it? The world used us as an excuse to go crazy, and then they blamed it on us.
Yeah, great quote, yeah.
And you know, when you reach that level where you are not just a person anymore in people's eyes, that you become on some other level, then you can become a focal point for disturbed people, disturbed individuals. And George and John did. You mentioned Take That. Another comparison could be Princess Diana, in the sense that she achieved this, you know, super duper level of global recognition, and it kind of crushed and destroyed her.
Mm.
You know, arguably.
I thought you were going to tell me a load of hits that she'd written.
So imagine if she'd started a pop career, what would that have been like?
Yeah, sometime on YouTube, there'll be like lots of her compositions. But no, I know what you mean. I think it's perhaps more the death. I think the death of John Lennon and the death of Princess Diana are perhaps quite comparable, because you've got this outpouring of grief that perhaps wasn't quite expected. I don't know.
And when a public figure like that dies, the public perception of them changes quite quickly, and they become, I don't know what the word for it is it they become a martyr. I'm not sure that's the right word, but they suddenly become a myth, you know, that the mythology is set in stone very quickly, and they cease to be, you know, just a normal person with their normal foibles and weaknesses, and, you know, and so he became immortalized in a weird way by dying. He suddenly became immortalized and became an icon. And we didn't get to see him kind of grow old and do you know, Paul McCartney didn't die. He continued and made songs that people have criticized him for, and became a family man in, I think, in a more genuine sense than John did. And he got criticized for some of those songs. Anyway.
Mm.
So there we go. That we managed to do it, I think, a general overview.
Yeah.
Now, the next thing, I did actually prepare some general questions for you. What do you think? I feel like we've kind of we've had a pretty good shot at discussing John Lennon.
I could do
Beatles.
Quick fire. I could do quick fire if you want. I'll try and give short answers.
Okay, quick fire. Let's try and do quick fire, although my questions are not really designed for it, but we'll give it a shot. Come on.
Medium fire.
Yeah, medium fire. Sort of medium paced fire. So, starting with quite an obvious question, maybe. That is, do you have a favourite John Lennon song? Go.
Oh, my God. Yes, it's changed a lot over the years, but I'm going to say a song called God from the Plastic Ono Band album, which is not one of his most well-known, but it's really got lots of staying power. I've just kind of found myself loving that song. Plastic Ono Band is my favourite John Lennon album, by a fair distance, in fact. So
yeah, God is the one where he kind of goes on and on about the things he doesn't believe in, right? I don't believe in Jesus, I don't believe in... I mean, I love the way he says, I don't believe in yoga.
it's not so much for the... Yeah, the lyrics are a bit sweeping, I agree. It's probably more for the music. And there's another song actually called Love from the same album. And if you listen to his vocal on that, it's just unbelievable. It's really amazing.
I do love God, though. I don't mean to kind of, make fun of the song or anything. I do love it. The music. Isn't there Billy Preston playing piano on that?
Yeah, there's two pianos, and Billy's playing obviously the more difficult, the gospel-y stuff, and John's playing a sort of rhythm piano, yeah.
Wonderfully sparse, lovely. And it's Ringo as well on drums, I think. Sparse, and Billy Preston's gospel-style piano. Oh, absolutely wonderful.
But just one thing I love about that is that he goes through, I don't believe in Beatles. And then when his voice comes back, he sings, I just believe in me. And he suddenly sounds like a child. And that's this ability he had. I don't know how much of it is the effects put on his voice. A lot of it must come from him. He has this ability to sound like an angry adult followed by like a sort of broken child.
Yeah.
And I think that album, Plastic Ono Band, because we did a show on it, so obviously I listened very attentively to it. And he just had this amazing ability to just transmit.
Yeah, emotions. Really interesting that he was... lots of different things, but yeah, he could be like very forceful and strong and with a lot of conviction, which is something that's really enjoyable to listen to. Like one of my favorite songs of his is And Your Bird Can Sing. And just the level of conviction, it's just exciting to listen to. It really sweeps you up, and you can kind of ride along with it. But yeah, you're right. He also had this incredible vulnerability that he could express as well.
I was thinking, I was answering actually John Lennon solo, just very briefly, Beatles. I can't get much past Strawberry Fields, Day in the Life, and I'm the Walrus, which is what I call the 1967 Holy Trinity. You know, those three amazing songs. There's a million others, of course, but
yeah,
I'd say those. Yeah.
Next question. So John Lennon had lots of different looks. Okay, so he looked very different in different phases of his life, with different haircuts, different facial hair, and just general... It's like if you had a different passport for each one of those looks, it could be like a different person.
You wouldn't recognize him, yeah. You wouldn't get through, yeah.
Yeah, he could have had lots of different... It's like all these different identities, as if he was a spy with all these different passports.
Yeah,
So which is your favorite of John Lennon's phases or looks?
I think definitely I love the 1968, 68, 69. 68 is without the beard. 69 is with the enormous beard and the white suit. And it's essentially the Jesus look. And in fact, weirdly enough, another weird coincidence, someone found an older, like a colouring book or a book from his infant school. And he drew a picture of Jesus that basically looked exactly like he looked.
But, oh, wow.
I think 68, sort of centre parting, round glasses. I don't know if he pioneered this look, but it's this sort of arty, intellectual, slightly stoned, slightly detached look. And I think that's my favourite. And a lot of it actually came from the fact that he was in quite a lot of trouble in 1968, drug-wise. But he just developed... That's my favourite, but I know what you mean. Like, there's almost a look for every single year, isn't there?
Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be my favourite.
Yeah, that is the iconic one. When you get a picture of John Lennon in an English language, in a TEFL course book, like Headway Upper Intermediate, which is always the one I mention, or English File or something, it's always that picture of him with the centre parting, the round glasses, maybe the denim jacket.
A sort of detached, slightly glazed look in his eyes, always.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's see. This is going to be difficult to answer this one in a broad in a quick way, but we're going to describe John Lennon in a moment, and we're going to look at lots of different descriptive adjectives. But overall, would you say that John's story or John's life is broadly positive or negative? And that could be from his point of view or from our point of view. If you appraise the entire life of John Lennon, as you have done, would you say that it's overall positive or negative?
I hate to sit on the fence, but I think the appeal of him is, in fact, that it's almost everything. You know, there's a weird thing where if you study his life, both the things we know about and the sort of different narratives and theories, you can find almost every facet of life there. You know, so it's very difficult to say. I would say if you take it that the most important thing about John Lennon is his music, you know, because the music is there, you know, you don't have to argue. You can argue about what's good and what's bad, but the music is there. I would say John Lennon, both with the Beatles and solo, is positive. Like, I think Beatles music is unbelievably uplifting. And obviously, it's a bit more Paul's sweeter, you know, more expansive melodies. John wasn't really a great melody writer necessarily. Well, probably pretty good compared to most people, but... So music-wise, I'd say very positive, very uplifting. Life-wise, I just think it's everything.
Yeah.
Light and dark, you know?
Yeah. For him, from his point of view, it could be arguable because, you know, the difficulties he had in his childhood. And I think he had, as you say, a big mix of ups and downs. He had moments of great joy and incredible inspiration and experiences that other people can't touch, really. Yeah. Visions and things that people will never see. But also I think he experienced a lot of great pain and probably paranoia and darkness too. But I would agree with you overall from our side, it's quite positive. I think his influence on the world has been broadly a positive one, and that he has been a force for good in the world in general, I would say.
He's almost like, I'm sure he didn't plan this, but artists are often like, they live out the life that perhaps you would like to live if you had the opportunity to be an actor or a musician or to do a job that's not a quote-unquote normal job. And I don't mean that as any, you know, I think teaching is a great job, for example. But, you know, I think artists live out this other people's fantasies. Perhaps you said earlier, you know, and as George Harrison said, you know, the artist is there to kind of be shot at. And they live out your fantasies, and when it goes wrong, you know, you can blame it on them, kind of thing.
Yeah, you can both hold them up and smash them down, weirdly.
Exactly.
Yeah. Not that I like the idea of smashing people down at all, but they do get smashed down, I suppose, in life. It's the position of the artist.
Well, you put them on a pedestal, and then you realise that all humans are fragile. You know, they're not mythical gods from, you know, ancient Egypt. They're just human beings, and they're always going to be fragile. And so, you know, they're always going to fall apart if you try and put them on a pedestal. And then I think it's a bit unfair of the public to then sort of turn on them, you know?
Yes.
Because if you, just to give one more example, you know, Amy Winehouse, you know, everyone will say now, oh, you know, poor Amy, I wish we'd helped her. But, you know, the tabloid media just, same, it's like Princess Diana, but with Amy Winehouse, you had the additional thing of alcoholism and drugs. So they had, not only was that something she was suffering from, but it's something the media could pillory her for. And if you saw the documentary Amy, the Netflix amazing film, they do a compilation of all like people on comedy panel shows making fun of her, and it makes me so angry when I look back at it.
It's very sad.
You know, it's very sad, but it will still happen. You know, I mean, we just don't. So I don't want to get angry here, but we don't really learn. You know, the same patterns just continually repeat, and it's quite annoying. But anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess when people get to a certain level of fame, they for some reason in people's eyes become dehumanized. And so people feel that it's okay to say things about them and make fun of them and so on. But they're still human beings ultimately. Okay.
Absolutely.
Next question. Now, this is another huge one. In fact, you could do a whole massive series of podcasts on this question, as some people have done. What do you think happened between Paul and John then? Paul McCartney and John Lennon, what happened between them? Do you think that, as some accounts go, or some people seem to think, do you think that John hated Paul in some way?
No, I don't think so. I think with John Lennon, what you have to remember is that, you know, you've heard about the primal therapy, I suppose. Yeah, he did this very, very heavy therapy, which I read the book, The Primal Scream, which is actually where the Scottish band got their name from. I think John Lennon, as you said, was very traumatized, and he went through a big LSD period and a heroin period. Then he had primal therapy, so he was a very, very fragile and kind of a wounded animal, and I think he turned it on Paul McCartney. So I don't think he ever hated him. I think essentially they were like brothers who weren't biologically brothers, but they had all the other hallmarks of brothers. So I think to understand them, you have to really think of it as a brother thing. You know, because they even lost their mothers. So you can imagine it as two brothers who lost their mother.
Yes.
Even though obviously they had different mothers in reality. So I don't think he hated him, but I think he was a little bit jealous. John Lennon was perhaps a little bit less mature, was quite an immature, childlike or childish person. And I think he was looking for someone to turn on.
He was looking for someone to turn on as well.
To turn on. Yeah. To turn on and to turn on, yeah.
Yeah. He was looking for someone to turn on and also to turn on. Yeah. People say that John sort of broke up the Beatles, or John left, or Paul left, you know, we can't decide. It's a total mess. But maybe John was trying to regain some level of control over the group, and that they never really wanted to break up, all of them. And that John's attempt to regain some level of control in the situation backfired on him. And that, you know, he kind of laid down the law and sort of brought in Alan Klein, or allowed Alan Klein to come in, who's this sort of brutal manager. And Paul, I think maybe John, I don't know, I'm speculating now, but maybe John was kind of like, look, you know, I'm leaving the group, which is what he did say. That didn't become public information, though. And I think Paul was supposed to go, oh shit, John's going to leave the group. All right, so we better, you know, better do it John's way. But Paul kind of went the other way and was like, well, you know, screw that. I'm not working with Klein. And there was that whole negotiation about Klein's management, where John, George and Ringo were saying to him, we've got to give him 20%. And Paul's going, we're a big act. He'll take 10. Anyway, there was just like this whole business negotiation. All right, so we're getting distracted, or I am.
Very, very, very quickly, I think also with the Yoko thing.
Did Yoko split up the Beatles? This is one of my questions.
It wasn't that she split up the Beatles. It was that John Lennon, as we said, was a pretty traumatized person, also a very, very creative person, artistic person. And when he met Yoko Ono, essentially, there's a guy called Victor Spinetti who was in some of the Beatles films. Really nice. Seemed like a very nice guy. Liked John Lennon a lot.
Actor.
An actor, yeah. He said when John Lennon met Yoko Ono, it's just like she took him back to being a kid. It's like if someone said, here's some crayons and here's a piece of paper. You can draw anything you want. Anything you do is valid. So I'm a bit sceptical about their relationship towards the end of his life, which I've almost done a whole series on Glass Onion. But I think at the beginning, he was so swept up, and he was one of those people. I actually had a therapist on the show as well who sort of confirmed this. So he's one of those people that I think traumatized people, when they see the person that they think is it, they're going to throw all their eggs in one basket. Another good expression.
Put all your eggs in one basket.
Put all your eggs in one basket. So he's like, Yoko is it. This is what I've been waiting for my whole life. You know, and I'm sure, as I said, they did drugs together, and drugs do have a way. You know, when you do drugs with someone, it's going to bond you even more, whatever you think about drugs. So I think that factor, I think in the end it was Yoko or the Beatles. And so he started bringing her to the sessions. Famously, they had a car crash, and she was injured, and they brought a queen size bed into the studio, and she was lying in bed, and he even set up a mic so she could comment on their music. if anything could be more surreal than that,
that's a famous, you can imagine. Famous. It's a famous quote, isn't it? Like, Yoko wants a microphone.
Yoko wants a mic. Yeah. Oh, just unbelievable.
Yoko wants a mic. And apparently, like, the other guys in the studio were like, what?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, everyone's like shitting themselves. Cause yeah. Oh shit. She's going to have a microphone now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think, again, I'm just speculating as well. I think when he met Yoko, he kind of put his eggs in one basket, and it was Yoko or the Beatles. So if they had any objection to her turning up at their sessions and commenting on their music, he was like, you know, screw you, I'm choosing her. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to know really what Paul thought about that. I think Paul wanted to keep them together, but then I think maybe a misconception is that he was desperate to get John back through the 70s. I'm not sure I agree with that. I think Paul accepted that the ban was over, and he, of course, ended up suing them in court. He had to take them to court, his three yeah. best mates, as he says it, to get himself out of the partnership with I don't know if it's with Klein, or Klein was obviously involved. So yeah, very, very, very messy business and very contentious.
They could well have worked again together in some way. I mean, they could have collaborated. They had to separate in order to establish themselves in their own right. But I think they could easily have worked together again. But it was there were various little obstacles that got in the way, and a business was one of those things, like the business issues, the publishing disputes, and they had to sort out the mess that was created when Brian Epstein died, who was their manager,
absolutely.
The one who had the kind of business vision for them, an absolutely pivotal character in the story, Brian. He died in 67, and that was obviously a huge turning point. And the music side was fine. They were doing really well all the way through. But from the business side, it was a total disaster. It's like the whole thing collapsed. And Apple, the whole Apple thing was just such a mess.
Yeah. Oh, it's terrible. It's just, yeah.
Yeah, so Apple, as a business venture, was a total disaster, and it caused them lots of legal trouble as it all had to be sorted out later.
Yeah, a good book called Apple to the Core, which was written soon after all this happened. So it's, I haven't read it for years, but I remember enjoying it. Also, The Longest Cocktail Party, fantastic book, written by a guy who was called the House Hippie. He was a young fella who was one of Derek Taylor's assistants. Amazing stuff, but yeah, an absolute mess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to do one more of these questions.
Okay.
And then we'll be ready to move on to part two.
We're ready to start the show.
That's right. Yes, listeners, this is still just part one. So here we have a third conditional. You can probably guess what it is.
Nice.
But it's, if John hadn't died, what would have happened?
Oh, that's what I ask on my show to my guests. So I've never had that turn back on me, but... Yeah, I actually, someone who's a journalist actually asked me to write something. So I actually wrote something about this. I've mulled it over a lot, but I think if he had lived past 1980, I think he would have been very involved with grunge. I can definitely see him collaborating with Kurt Cobain. I'm fairly sure that could happen. But John Lennon may have just become a recluse. You know, we might not have seen him much. But I think he would have been well into hip hop. I don't think he would have performed it. I hope he wouldn't. Anyway, that would have been embarrassing. But he would have loved the activism side of rap and hip hop. The fact that you didn't really have to write lyrics. You could just speak directly. And John Lennon was all about speaking directly. So I think grunge, hip hop, I could see him sort of popping in and out of the public eye. I think he definitely would have been on Twitter a lot. And one thing that we've all agreed, he would have spent a lot of time writing angry tweets and then having to apologize for them. Pretty sure about that. Yeah. So he would have loved the internet because he, a bit like Donald Trump, he could have been lying in bed at like and just firing off sort of missives to the world. Like you can imagine John Lennon in a slight sort of weed haze. Typing into his phone, if he had a phone, something along the lines of, I am he, as you are me, and we are all together, which is a line from I Am the Walrus. You can imagine him firing off something like that because it's instant. He doesn't take any effort. He can do it in his bed. He can kind of tweet, and he can reach the whole world. And I think that's very John Lennon. So he would have loved the internet. Would he have survived? I don't know. You know, I mean, he was a heavy smoker, as was George Harrison. So it's possible that, you know, I don't want to be morbid, but cancer may have taken him at some point. But I think he would have popped in and out of the public eye. I don't think he would have been like a jobbing musician. He wouldn't be touring like Paul, but I think he probably would have done the occasional, maybe a world tour. So, yeah, it's great for speculation, though, isn't it? I mean, what do you think? Let me turn it back on the host.
Well, I can't speculate really with any level of accuracy, of course. I don't know. I mean, you've, I think, profiled him probably a lot more in a more detailed way than me.
Right.
So I don't have a accurate speculation. Instead, I have a sort of a dream of sorts where I imagine John having moved back to England. Mm. And a bit like David Bowie in the noughties, right, from sort of 2000 and beyond, when David Bowie sort of started appearing on a lot of those chat shows with Jonathan Ross, and you got the impression he was hanging out with a lot of comedians in the UK. Mm. He was hanging out with Ricky Gervais and stuff like that, and he was on radio. Was he on Radio 2? He might have been, appeared on Jonathan Ross's BBC Radio 2 show or something like that. But a sort of a personality that would sort of turn up sometimes. So I had this kind of lovely idea that John Lennon might have, and this is very sort of, what's the word for it? Middle of the road, actually.
Mm.
But this idea that he could have got his own show on Radio 2.
Yeah.
And it would have been him kind of, it wouldn't have worked because he's too edgy for that. But, because one of the things I love about Lennon is his humour.
Mm.
And he did appear on the radio a few times. There was one notable occasion in the 70s when he was on radio to promote one of his albums, and he was taking all these calls from callers. And it's just so much fun.
He's so charismatic, isn't he?
He's so charismatic. So I would have loved him to have a radio show or a podcast to just sort of ramble. And just so we could listen to John Lennon talking. That was one of my favourite things about him, is just listening to him talk. He's so charismatic and articulate and funny and witty. And that's one of my favourite things about Lennon. So I would love him to have had his own radio show or podcast that we could have listened to. That would have been fun.
Yeah, one other thing is that he did have very good relationships with Elton John and David Bowie, because he worked with both of them. So I feel like he was probably always a bit too insecure to go out on his own. Obviously, he had Yoko with him when he was performing in the 70s, but I feel like perhaps, you know, he might have turned up at David Bowie's concerts, or he already performed with Elton John at Madison Square Garden. But I feel like he's always a bit afraid of stepping out on his own. So I think, and with Paul McCartney, in fact, we know the fact in this wonderful period of Beatles books and podcasts where history is being revised all the time, we actually know almost as fact that John Lennon was about to collaborate with Paul in 1975 and 1981. And some podcasters are more sure than others, but there's a lot of people who are very, very good Beatles scholars, and I take their word for it. And it seems like Yoko was the sticking point, that perhaps she did want to keep John away from his old life. You know, his English mates, so to speak, which is not like totally unknown. You know, I mean, he wouldn't be the first guy to have a wife or a girlfriend who wanted to separate him from his old mates. You know, I've kind of had that myself. So,
yeah, that does happen. I mean, it's not making a statement about women, but when people get into couples, they do kind of, you know, they want their partner to be at home with them in their life. They don't necessarily want, especially if the person is quite insecure and. Mm. You know, we're not really talking about Yoko, but I expect she had her insecurities as well.
Sure.
Even though she was also sort of quite a formidable person, but I'm sure she was quite fragile and insecure too. And so she wanted John to be there in her home and in her life, and she didn't necessarily want him to run off and be partying with his mates and stuff. She might have been scared that he would leave her or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's not, you know, yeah, but she gets demonized a lot, Yoko.
Definitely.
Which is sad, but yeah, it's fairly reasonable, I guess. But yeah, so yeah, they that would have been cool though, them getting together.
Yeah, I don't imagine that they would have done a lot together, but they might have got together for Live Aid. That was an option in 85. And then obviously the anthology. And there's a kind of backstory to the anthology that George Harrison had been majorly ripped off by his business manager. So one of the actual reasons that he got involved was for money. I mean, I hate to be cynical, but that is kind of the truth. Because if you watch the anthology, George is kind of, he realizes that Paul's going to take the limelight, and he kind of steps to the side and is a bit detached. And I can imagine, do you remember when there's Paul, George and Ringo sitting in George's garden strumming ukuleles?
Oh, yeah.
On the show, we speculated about what would it be if John had been there as well. And I kind of feel like John and George would have been either side of Paul, sort of gently taking the piss out of him, as we would say, mocking him. Because Paul's going to take the limelight almost, you know, it's almost like a reflex action, you know, with Paul McCartney. He just does it, doesn't he? Because he's just so good at it. So it's so interesting to speculate. In a way, it's almost how these podcasts, all these Beatles podcasts, have kept going, because no one knows the truth. And, you know, there's all kinds of things that we're never going to know. Like, for example, when they went to India to do the meditation, they're in this wonderfully kind of spiritual, peaceful place. They're probably off hard drugs at least for a couple of months. But then they go to the White Album and all hell breaks loose. And it's, yeah, again, so something happened. There's loads of things that happen behind the scenes that we're probably never going to know, because none of their children are going to tell us, are they? You know, no. Sean Lennon's not going to tell us the truth. You know, what's her name? Stella McCartney's not going to tell us the truth. Yeah, the children have taken the mantle of essentially keeping the official version going. You know what I mean? So,
yeah, or at least, yeah, protecting the interests of the legacy and the memory of their parents who they love so much, and so on. And maybe even they don't know either.
Sure, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I don't mean to have a go at anybody. You know, it's very, very difficult to be in the public eye, as we said earlier. And, yeah, it's not having a go at people. It's just a kind of thirst for the truth, you know, which that's what we have as Beatles fans. And that's what I have with my other podcast about the world. You know, what is the truth? You know, are there conspiracies or are there no conspiracies? Is everything a conspiracy? Who the hell knows, you know?
Yes, it's so, a nebulous thing.
Yeah.
There's a nice word.
Yeah, good word, yeah. But it's wonderfully fertile for someone who's curious and, you know.
Absolutely.
Anyway.
Anthony, now we're going to have a shot at part two of this. We have three parts planned. I don't know if we're going to get to the third part. That might have to be another one for another time.
No, we can always record another day, because I'm absolutely loving this. This is great. So I could do this all day, so don't worry.
Okay, great. So that was episode two in this five-part Beatles mini-series. Thank you again to Anthony for his contribution to this episode and the forthcoming ones. This was all about John Lennon. And the other John Lennon episodes will follow over the next few weeks. So do you feel that you now know more about John Lennon than you did before you listened to this? I hope so. I hope you picked up a few sort of new factoids in there. I wonder what new things you learned from this, and feel free to leave your comments below. Okay, I'm very curious to know if you learned some things about John Lennon from listening to this. I won't say much more here, except that it's been really interesting to talk to Anthony, and I look forward to publishing the next few episodes in which we go into teacher mode and look at some descriptive adjectives and then song lyrics. But that's it for this episode. Thank you for listening all the way through to the end here. Actually, wait a minute. I forgot to add something. I was just wrapping up the episode there. I was just about to finish, but I forgot something. And that something is this: music. How could I forget music? I don't know. But anyway, I got here at the last second. Music. Yeah. So you might remember that a few episodes ago, I don't remember which episode it is now, but I recorded myself singing "I'm Only Sleeping" by the Beatles. It's one of those songs I did at the end of an episode recently. I don't actually record or remember which episodes have songs at the end. And so sometimes people say to me, why don't you do why don't you do like an album on Bandcamp or something of all the songs that you've done? And I just think, yeah, that's a good idea, but I don't know where they all are. Anyway, I did "I'm Only Sleeping," which is that song written by John Lennon. And then Rob from English with Rob, I don't know if you know about English with Rob, but Rob was someone I used to work with in Paris in school. We used to work together. Anyway, he does lots of online stuff and he's doing a podcast. He's going to be a guest on this podcast soon, coming up at some point. But Rob sent me a version of "I'm Only Sleeping." It's the one that I recorded for this podcast. But he recorded drums over the top, because Rob is lucky enough to have a drum kit in his basement in his home, which is amazing. And so he recorded himself playing drums over the top of my version of "I'm Only Sleeping," and he sent it to me. So I thought I would play it to you at the end of this episode. Okay, so this is a sort of musical collaboration podcast crossover between me and Rob from English with Rob. And I hope you enjoy it. And at the end of this, I will say goodbye in the usual way. And then you can just go about your day. Okay, all right, here we go. When I wake up early in the morning, lift my head, I'm still yawning when I'm in the middle of a dream. Stay in bed, floats upstream, floats upstream. Please don't wake me, no, don't shake me. Leave me where I am, I'm only sleeping. Everybody seems to think I'm lazy. I don't mind, I think they're crazy. Running everywhere at such a speed until they find there's no need, there's no need. Please don't spoil my day, I'm miles away, and after all, I'm only sleeping. Keeping an eye on the world going by my window, taking my time, lying there and staring at the ceiling, waiting for a sleepy feeling. Please don't spoil my day, I'm miles away, and after all, I'm only sleeping. Keeping an eye on the world going by my window, and taking my time when I wake up early in the morning. Lift my head, I'm still yawning when I'm in the middle of a dream. Stay in bed, float upstream, float upstream. Please don't wake me, no, don't shake me. Leave me where I am, I'm only sleeping.
That's it, folks. Thank you for listening. Be excellent to each other. And carry on, all right? Keep calm and carry on. Have a lovely day, and I'll speak to you in the next episode, which will be coming soon. But for now, it's time to say goodbye. Bye,
bye, bye, bye, bye, bye, bye.
Thanks for listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.